You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
No, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the final show of the Tech Talk Summer Series for this summer. I'm Andrew McComb. Well, I'm pleased to say that the team is well-rested and chafing at the bit to get back into the studio for 2009. And what a year it's shaping up to be. The global financial crisis is the real wild card in this year, with the funding for major infrastructure projects such as the National Broadband Network and business expansion under threat. The NBN panel has released its report to the government, but Conroy is keeping the lid on. The shedding of jobs and decline in profits in the IT sector globally is disturbing. Rumours abound about Apple and Microsoft's ability to weather the storm, with both companies having their own unique set of problems in front of them. So before we get started on the last show for the summer series, don't forget to join the Tech Talk Radio mailing list. Each week you'll receive our Monday morning newsletter letting you know what's in store for the show that evening. If you're a Twitter fan, make sure you follow us. This way, you'll be kept up to date with all the news and information that we think is relevant to Tech Talk listeners. To sign up for the newsletter or to follow us on Twitter, visit the Tech Talk Radio website, techtalkradio.com.au, for all the details. Now onto today's show. We'll revisit some of the more memorable views Adam Turner has had from his couch. Adam is a freelance IT journalist who writes for many of the notable papers and online, including The Age, The Sydney Morning Herald and IT Wire. Adam joins us each week with his view on what's happening in Australian and global technology. Right now, though, it's time for some astronomy. Perry Vlahos, president of the Victorian Astronomical Society, joined us in the studio to give us an insight into the wonderful and scientific world of astronomy.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And Perry Vlahos joins us here in the Tech Talk Radio studios. I guess let's start off tonight and talk about astronomy in general. Popularity in astronomy is it good at the moment? How's it? Are there many people interested in this sort of thing?
Extremely popular. Yeah? There's, of course, it's a cutting edge science that uses lots of high tech equipment, but at the same time, it's also one of the few sciences that amateurs can actually make a substantial contribution to without any of the high-tech materials and equipment that's required. So it spans a very wide and broad spectrum of interest there, and it's easy for people to get into. After all, it doesn't cost anything to look up at the sky.
No, that's true. That's true. So astronomy starts by standing in the backyard on a starry night with a book or maybe even a computer or connected up to the internet maybe online. Is that how it sort of starts?
Well, not really with a computer connected to the internet, because there's a problem there. One of the main problems with astronomy, certainly from backyards and in any populated urban areas, is light pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got a laptop there with its screen all lit up, it's doing exactly the same thing as all the lighting around the place. So the problem with lighting is that lighting makes your pupils close down if it's bright white light. And so that takes a while again for the pupils to open up to their widers to be able to see the faintest objects in the sky. So, as I like to say, the natural enemy of the astronomer is the electric lamp. So, no, you don't want to take a computer outside and use it with you unless you can make the screen very, very dim and very red, because red is the colour that least affects our eyes. That's why astronomers have red torches.
Okay.
And you might
presumably print out your star chart from the computer before you go and take it on paper. That, would be
that's
better.
A good way to do it. Print it out and then take a red torch with you. Now, to make a red torch, it requires some very high-tech stuff.
Oh, yes.
Some red paper and rubber band.
Oh, sticky tape.
Well, rubber band over the front of it to keep it fastened on, and it becomes a red torch, but not a bright red torch. It still has to be dim. So cellophane is not much good, and paper a number of layers over the front of it.
Okay. Okay, good tip. So you head out there into the backyard with your star chart and your highly modified torch. So you look up in the sky. What do you see, apart from stars?
Well, depends on where you are. If you're in a suburban area, you're not going to see very many things. If there's a lot of light pollution, you'll see the brighter stars, which may only number as many as 20 or less.
Yep.
And you'll see some of the brighter planets as well.
Which planets can you see?
With a naked eye?
Yeah.
You can see Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, plus one more, Earth.
I'd have to look down for that one, though.
It doesn't matter where you look, you still see it.
That's the trick question on the test, I can imagine that. because you walk out...
Actually, Graham, I'll take you up on that one because, no, you don't have to actually look down to see Earth either, because you can see the shadow of the Earth being projected into the atmosphere once the sun goes under the horizon. So you can still look up and see evidence of the Earth being there.
Fair enough. All right, I stand corrected.
But it's in the eastern sky, directly opposite where the sun is in the west. It's an interesting effect. It looks like... a sort of purpley bluish hue going over across the atmosphere, and it's well worth looking out for if you're ever in a area where there's a low horizon and you can physically see the Earth.
That is a horizon without mountains or anything like
or
that.
Or trees and houses
out,
and buildings.
Out north of Victoria, or even out the Tablelands of Queensland or something like that.
Just anywhere where it's flat.
How far out of town do you need to get to a point where you can see interesting things in the sky?
We have a dark sky site, which is about 150 kilometres north of Melbourne, just over the Great Divide, about 20 kilometres out of the township of Heathcote in central Victoria. Now, you don't have to go that far. Basically, you can get away anywhere within half an hour of the outer suburbs should start revealing the better and... Well, saying better is probably... not the right way to put it, but being able to see the fainter objects in the sky, like the Milky Way, for example. I don't know whether either of you can ever remember seeing the Milky Way from the city.
Well, you can see it.
Not from the city. I think it's...
You can see it.
A long time since you would have seen the Milky Way.
We've got a property up north, and it's great. You walk out there in the middle of the night, and all you can see is stars from horizon to horizon, and you look straight up, and you can see the Milky Way, and it is just sensational.
It's one of the most magnificent things that you can see with the naked eye, but unfortunately, many of our children have never seen it, and unless they can get out of town, they're not going to see it either. Can I relate an interesting story from
please do.
A friend who has Japanese students staying? And one time, two of them were taken out on a camping trip out in Victoria, somewhere in the rural countryside, and these two kids couldn't get to sleep. They were up talking all night, and so they were asked, "What's going on? Why aren't you sleeping?" And they said, "Well, we've never seen this before."
Yeah,
and they were pointing up to the sky and all the stars in the sky. They'd never seen stars before because they were from Tokyo, and it's such a built-up, lit-up area that they never had the experience.
It's a bit sad that you have to come to a country like ours to actually experience that, though, isn't it?
But it's very fortunate for us.
All
we have to do is just get out of town and we can see it like that.
It is. And having travelled to Europe and the United States, well, same thing applies in the major city areas. Apart from light spill, the pollution is just... You can lucky to see half a dozen stars in the sky over in some countries. So,
and unfortunately, one of the great things we will never see again, unless we do something about light pollution, is we'll never see a great comet hanging over the city or a large town because of those lights. Now, comets are inherently reasonably faint objects, so if there's lighting around, they just tend to disappear. Now, one of the great pushes in the society is to see if we can get lighting that's a little bit like the one you've got over there, actually, Andrew, on your left, where it's pointing down and it's not going sideways and upwards because it's got a shield over the top of it. So
it's like the old street lights.
It's not that we want less lighting, but better and more effective
lighting. Point it down. Don't let it go everywhere.
Exactly. And not going sideways and upwards.
That would be more energy efficient as well if you've got the light directed to where you want to use it.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Graham.
So it makes sense on a number of fronts.
Less wattage is being used, smaller bulbs, less electricity, greenhouse gases, coal, etc. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. Mm. Money.
You mentioned comets before. I remember the last comet that I saw, I was it's when I got married, actually, about 10 years ago. We were in Western Australia.
Was it a portent of good faith? I think so.
I was in Broome at the time, and I was looking westward, and you could see it. I think it was Hale Bopp, or I'm really not sure, but I remember that was the last sort of one. And it was absolutely fascinating at night because, once again, I was fortunate because in those sort of rural areas, they run some terrific or the local astronomy clubs run some terrific nighttime visits where they go out and explain things because they took us down to the car park and they said, you know, you think this stone here is Earth and this stone here is the sun. Well, if you put a stone millions of miles away, that's what that star up there looks like. So it puts the whole thing into perspective, which I think is just fantastic. But, that was one of my recollections from Broome, seeing one of the last comets that I saw about 10 years ago. So.
That could have been either Hale-Bopp or it could have been Comet Haikutake as well.
Hale-Bopp seems to come to mind.
Closer to the horizon for us in the southern hemisphere. Haikutake was much higher and much more impressive, actually. Okay. Than Hale-Bopp.
So hopefully people have got their astronomy memories like that, because there must have been quite a few of those events through the course of time which has brought on astronomy. Like, do you find that you get a comet like that and all of a sudden you get a mass rush of people signing up to join astronomy societies and things like that?
Well, with Comet Halley, people that were in the Astronomical Society of Victoria before I was said there was a large influx of members during the year that Comet Halley was around. And I think we gauge it today by the amount of inquiries we get and hits on the website and phone calls.
Yep.
So they always tend to go up whenever there's some sort of new phenomenon in the sky or some celestial event that's occurring. Things like when Mars was very close a couple of years ago, or when there was a lunar eclipse or a total solar eclipse, as there was in 2002 that went over South Australia. They're the things that get a lot of people's attention and looking into the sky. But astronomy is a sort of science that has a lot of kids becoming interested because they learn about it in school and they want to go out and look up for themselves. So it's quite a popular pursuit.
So if you come along to your local astronomy club, what would you expect? Do they all sit around at night and with the overhead projector and talk about, let's go out and look at this? Or what goes on at a local astronomy club?
Well, it depends on what level of meeting you go to. If it's a general meeting, that's basically a few talks. I do a Sky for the Night where we use computer simulations using planetarium programs projected up and people can see what's in the sky over this next month that they can go out and have a look at. But it's not generally something where it's nice and informal and people can come in and say hi and meet them and whatever.
Yeah.
It's more of a formalised type of meeting and it's not a good one for new members to go to, although sometimes we have some very interesting guest speakers. The better things to go to are nights when we're doing what we call astronomy for the people, where we take large portable telescopes out into the community, whether it be in a park or like last Friday where we took some telescopes down to Brayside Park, or whether it be something like where we go to the top rooftop car park of Victoria Garden Shopping Centre and have people
I've heard
come
you
up,
do that, yeah.
Yeah, and have people come up and have a look at that. That's probably the easiest way to get into astronomy in terms of being able to look through a large telescope and getting information from members that are in charge of that particular telescope.
Okay.
Another way is to go to some of our what we call club section meetings, and that occurs on the first Friday and the last Friday of the month at the ASV Lodge, which is here in Burwood. So if probably a matter of 3 or 4 kilometres from where we are, close to the intersection of Warrigal Road and Burwood Highway.
Uh-huh.
But all members have to do is ring up the ASV or go to our website and send the club section director a message and say, look, we'd like to come along, and he'll send out some information about how to get to it. And his name is Vince Loschiavo. So if anyone looks him up at the ASV's website, which is www.asv.org.au.
All right. Now, let's say I come along to one of those events and I go, wow, this is for me. I really want to get something so I can stand in the backyard or take portable or something. I'm not sure. How much is it going to cost me to get in to buy a small telescope? And do you get value for money with telescopes? Are there like pros and cons that you got to be wary of when you're buying something like that? Or will just a good old set of binoculars do the trick?
Your last one is the best way to start, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Binoculars are cheap. They're easy to handle. They don't take a lot to be able to know how to focus them and hold them up to the sky. I mean, they're so easy, even a footballer could use them. You know, It's just dead simple stuff. So are there any footballers listening? I apologise, and I change it to cricketers or rugby players. So you can change that to whatever you like. And, of course, if it's cloudy, you can always take them to the footy or the cricket or the beach or
so get a bit of extra
watching.
Use out of them.
Yeah, you certainly do. And I would suggest don't spend more than about $150 on a pair of binoculars.
Yeah.
Save your money for when you're ready to buy a telescope. But binoculars give you great views of the sky in much more detail than what you would ever acquire with your naked eye.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you'll be able to see craters on the moon with them. If you can hold them steady by
balancing
them.
That's the trick, isn't it?
Yeah,
lean up against something solid or something.
Yeah, the roof of a car or the bonnet of a car, putting your elbows on them while you're holding them. Some binoculars also come with screw holes that you can mount on a camera tripod.
Yeah.
That's a good trick.
And that becomes very,
very steady.
So there's
a good tip. If you're buying binoculars, make sure you can mount them on a tripod. That'd be great, wouldn't it?
See that they've got a screw hole in the bottom.
That's the trouble I always have with binoculars, is can't hold them still.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's a solution for everybody that wants to do that. And once you can hold them steadily enough like that, you can even see the moons of Jupiter.
Wow.
Yep.
Can't see the rings of Saturn, but you can see
moons
of Jupiter.
I've seen Jupiter moons through Dad's binoculars, and it's a fascinating sight. It really is.
They look just like little
tiniest little pinpricks
of light,
just
right
around the bright.
Yep, the object that is Jupiter in the centre. So that would be my suggestion for people wanting to get into it. Get the binoculars first of all. Learn the sky. Find out what some of the brightest stars are, what some of the main constellations are, and how you can use a sky chart. That's really, really important.
And that's something that the club would help out with.
Yep. I actually run some courses on for people learning how to read charts, and we call it observing the constellations, where we take them out to a park, give them a chart, they can bring along their binoculars and their red torches, and I'll pinpoint where these objects are that are in their charts and how to use them, which way
to
turn
them,
where they have to be facing, etc. And with a very bright green laser pointer, I point out the constellations and brighter stars. Now, this green laser pointer goes out for about 2 kilometres into the sky. And
take planes
very,
out with it,
very
it?
Easy. Well, no. It is a dangerous weapon. And, in fact, in Victoria, they're banned. You have to have a licence.
Oh, really?
In fact, I'm only one of two people that has a licence to use one of these things.
Okay.
Because they are prohibited weapons and they have as much as 30 milliwatts of power. The one that I use for people to be able to see it in areas that are light polluted, you need something fairly
strong. And you'd be able to get onto that course by through the website again, would you?
Yep. People
through
can send me an email directly to me if they like, and it's Perry, P-E-R-R-Y, at asv.org.au.
We'll put all these links up on our website as well so that people can come through us and click through as well if they don't have a pen or they're listening on a train in the tube, as quite often happens these days. We have listeners who travel the London Tube listening to us at the moment, too.
The London Tube.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Well, hello to everyone out here in London.
We're talking about learning the sky. So once you've learnt the sky, obviously it's a dynamic, ever-changing sort of sort of thing, I guess, with visiting...
But in a finite sense, actually, Andrew, because the seasons repeat themselves after a year.
Okay.
Now, the planets may have moved their positions along because they're constantly travelling eastward in their orbits around the sun. So for us, they also appear to travel towards the east in our sky. So if Jupiter is, say, this year currently, it's probably above the horizon right now in the east, if anyone's listening right now. And if it's not cloudy wherever you are, it'll be the brightest object in the eastern sky before about midnight.
Some of them call the morning the evening star?
No, that's Venus.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
That's why I need to go to one of these courses.
And Jupiter is in the constellation of Libra at the moment, or the stars of what we loosely call Libra, many light years behind Jupiter, so it's a foreground shortening thing. But next year, as it moves along over through this year, it'll be in the next constellation along, which is Scorpius, right? So, and they keep moving, but the planets are so bright that most of the time you can't actually miss them.
And they don't twinkle that much, do they? Unlike a star
they're
does.
Very steady because they actually have some angular diameter, whereas the stars do
the
not
point
have
of light.
Any. Yeah, and the only reason we can see them is because they're so bright that our eyes can't ignore them, not because they have any angular diameter whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep, get to the sky is a finite thing. Get to learn it. And also do some reading up on astronomy so that when you do finally have a look through a telescope, or you're thinking about having a look through a telescope, what you see doesn't come as a great surprise or a disappointment or whatever, so that you know what you should be looking
for. I think that's the key to it, really, isn't it? Because you go out there and you look up, especially if you're out in the countryside somewhere, and you see this magnificent array of, you know, stars in front of you, but you're just not quite sure which one's which. And I think a little bit of knowledge, once you get out there, you can go, oh, that's such and such, and that's such and such. And
yes, exactly. Having a telescope is great, but what are you going to look at?
You've got plenty to see with the naked eye, haven't you?
Yeah. So you need to know what you're going to look at before you get the telescope.
Perry, we'll be back in just a minute. We'll talk about all sorts of other things like the Hubble and radio astronomy and things like that. So if you're listening to us, stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
How easy is it to generate 100 points without photo ID these days?
Elections must cost the economy millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in lost productivity.
So is the coverage any better? That's the million-dollar question.
There's also a new patch for the iPhone.
Please read the screens as you click next, next, next.
Why? We've never had before.
And but people are stupid. I've said it once. I'll say it again.
Listen.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, in 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus had again had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPod.
Betty's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking for the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
And you put the date on ePray, it goes, and you get a whole service. Just on, how does it go? It goes.
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. You're with Graham and my good self, Andrew McColl. And on the other side of the desk, our special guest this evening is Perry Vlahos. He's in from the Astronomical Society of Victoria. And as we got chatting before, Perry, let's stick to our initial plan to talk about magazines and books and things like that and websites. Where should someone sort of head off in, if they're in the general sort of, I just want to learn a bit more about it, where should they go?
We're very fortunate at the moment, Andrew, because with the advent of the internet, there is so much information on astronomy that I'm sure your whole life you couldn't go through it all. And there's many, many good websites to have a look at. But I might just point out a few for the listeners out there that may get them started. First of all, the Astronomical Society of Victoria website, which is www.asv.org.au. And that will let them find other links that are relevant to us here locally.
Yeah.
And as the ASV is the largest astronomical association in the Southern Hemisphere, we've got nearly 1,000 members and lots of different groups and different happenings that are occurring within the societies, which basically means that you can do something with the ASV on almost every night of each month. You know,
okay.
There's something going on somewhere.
Yep.
So that's a good one to begin with. There are other links from there to local telescope shops, other societies if you're out in the countryside or whatever.
Yep.
Now, if you want something physical that you can hold in your hand, I would suggest for starters, for charts, the best website to go to is skymaps.com. Now that's run by
Australian site.
It's actually run by someone from South Australia, Kim Thalassoudis, which is a friend of mine, and he probably does the best web-based charts that you can find anywhere.
Wow,
he does one for the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
He also does one for the Southern Hemisphere.
Okay,
now, what you do is you can download it as a PDF, print it out, and then go outside. There's also information on what is being displayed on the chart on a second page, which tells you what the objects are and how far away they are and that sort of thing.
Is there an instruction guide or user guide on how to read the maps on there for those that have never been there before?
There is, Andrew, but it may not be terribly obvious to everyone first up, so I'll say a couple of things for anyone that does go to that sort of website. First of all, make sure that if the chart is a round chart, that whatever direction you're facing in the sky, that that direction is at the bottom of your chart, because you can move the chart around like a clock face. And so if you're looking to the south, make sure that the chart is turned with south at the bottom.
Okay.
If you're looking to the east, make sure that the bottom of your chart says east. So you keep turning
down the
chart.
Bottom. Yeah.
And never look past halfway in any direction. So never go past halfway in the center of the chart.
Okay.
If you need to go past halfway, which means you're looking at the opposite direction, you need to face that direction and turn the chart
around. So halfway straight up, basically.
The zenith, the point directly above your head. And that's usually designated in the chart by just a small plus sign.
Yeah. Now, do these charts update regularly or how often?
Oh, yes, there's one for every month.
Okay, so it's monthly type sort of update.
Yep, exactly. So you can download one every month and you can use it for that particular month and it'll be perfectly accurate. Now, other things, some good magazines that people can find in their newsagent if they want to go in there and get something they can physically hold in their hand. Australian Sky and Telescope is probably the best one locally. And I'm not saying that because I write for them, but because it really is the best one for Australia. There is another magazine, and you can compare the two if you like, called Sky and Space, which is also another Australian publication. There are some international ones. The only one I would recommend is Astronomy Magazine, which comes in from the US.
Okay.
That's a very good magazine because it also has a southern hemisphere chart for us. Oh,
okay, because I was going to say, is it very northern hemisphere-centric as well? Or?
Well, most of the information in there is based on the northern hemisphere, but it does have a chart for the southern hemisphere, and also because sometimes it takes a little while to get here, the southern hemisphere charts is for 2 months ahead. So if you get the February edition, which is probably in the news agents now, it will have the April southern hemisphere chart, right, which we'll need in a couple of days or something.
All right. Now, you were also talking during the little break about cheap telescopes. You were going to recommend
Very fortunate these days, and unlike what it used to be 30 or 40 years ago, or even 20 and 10 years ago, we now have the proliferation of what we call Dobsonian telescopes.
Yeah, now, so what's a Dobsonian telescope?
Well, a Dobsonian is one that was made popular by John Dobson.
Okay.
John Dobson is a story in himself. He is 90 years old. He was out here about the middle of last year or, around about then, and he had his 90th birthday while he was here with us. The last time he was out here, he was here in 85, and he stayed with me for a couple of nights and my ex-partner, and he was 80 years old, and he had brought along his 15-year-old son. If you're a man out there, I say do the math and weep. But he used to be a monk for a long time.
Really?
And that's when he came up with this idea.
You have plenty of time to study the stars when you're a monk, really, don't you?
The Dobsonian telescope came to fruition then.
Okay.
Which means it was a large aperture, large mirror, cheap to make and easy to use telescope that he used to wheel out into the streets of San Francisco and show passers-by the sky.
Yep.
But unfortunately, the abbot was a little bit annoyed, and he said, you've got to make up your mind. You've got to either be here or be out there.
Can't do both.
He decided to leave. But so these telescopes... Sorry, Grant.
So these are the ones that they're a big, round, barrel-type thing, and you look in the side of them.
Yes,
the ones?
Exactly.
Okay.
Which look a little bit like a cannon. They basically go up and down and around and around. And so just exactly like a cannon. I think that's where he got his idea from. You know, so... and the glass that he used to grind these mirrours...
Made his own glass. Oh, yeah, he ground his own glass.
Made his own mirrours, not his own glass. But from the glass that was cast...
Because that's an art in itself, isn't it?
Portholes in ships that were decommissioned after the Second World War.
Oh, really?
He got the portholes and ground them cheaply because they were there in US Navy and Army surplus stores, and made the mirrours cheaply. And I had these
Why that glass? Telescopes. Like, was that glass just the way they made it? It was a quality glass? Or why did he choose old portholes? Or the old glass from the old portholes?
No. Just as good as any other
normal glass. There's no real reason. It's just available.
And cheap.
Okay.
So he could buy one for a few, $2 or $3 and make a cheap telescope.
Okay. Now
and the rest of it is all wooden and very easy to move around and absolutely the easiest thing to use. I cannot stress that the Dobsonian telescope is without any peer whatsoever in the ease of its movement and use.
Yep.
And you can get large apertures now relatively cheaply. Even though they were originally supposed to be made by the user themselves, now factories have gotten onto them. And we get very cheap ones now in from China. And you can get...
What's the glass like? Is it good?
Yeah, the quality is reasonably good.
Yeah.
And you can get a cheap one now for around about an 8-inch glass for about $600. A whole telescope... mounting, tube, a couple of eyepieces to go with it, and a finder scope on top of it.
Okay.
8-inch diameter, which is enough to be able to see most things that you'll want to see.
Can you see galaxies and things like that?
From a dark sky, yes.
Okay.
Although, Andrew, if anyone out there is thinking they're going to see galaxies with big spiral arms and
you're going to be sadly disappointed.
They will be sadly disappointed. It takes a very large telescope to show spiral arms. But not only that, you also need to train your eye to see better and your mind to work better with your eye. So I've had experiences where I've climbed to the top of a ladder of a large telescope and thinking, wow, you know, these, I can see the Horsehead Nebula really well tonight, easy to see and well defined. And someone would come up the ladder after me, look in the eyepiece and go,
where?
Where? Yeah. So you need to teach your eye to also how to observe.
So that goes back to the learning the sky,
exactly.
And using the binoculars to start off with, and then buying a telescope like this later on.
So, well, you can buy a telescope like this a little way into it, but don't expect to see as much as you can see later on, because it'll take a while for you to train yourself and your eye to be able to see better.
And this is where you keep going back to the club meetings and doing
exactly. And hanging out with other astronomers.
Well, that's the thing. It's the group, isn't it?
Brain.
Yeah. Sit down and have coffee and a good chat and work out what the deal is.
Exactly. Or also going to some of the nights that we have out in the parks or to our dark sky site as well. Or the star parties that we throw.
Yeah.
Like we had the autumnal Messier star party just 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we had between 200 and 250 people go to that, with more than 50 or 60 telescopes out in the observing field. So that's a great opportunity for people that want to get into buying a telescope to go in and have a look at lots of different types and be able to compare them before they shell out their hard-earned money.
We're running out of time rapidly, Perry, but which means we must invite you in one more time. But I'd like to talk about two things in particular. Obviously, any upcoming astronomical events that maybe we can see with the naked eye. Is there anything like that that's coming up in the next little bit?
Well, if we were in a line from Western Africa through to Eastern Europe, we may be able to see an eclipse in a couple of days' time, a total solar eclipse. But unfortunately, in the Southern Hemisphere, we won't be able to see it.
Okay.
However, with this wonderful technology on the net, you can have it being netcast.
So there's webcams out there looking for eclipses, yeah?
Yep. Go to a website called skyandtell.com, which is www.skyandtell.com, which is the USA version of Sky and Telescope.
Yep.
And you'll find lots of stuff there as to how you can find other websites that are netcasting these things.
Fantastic. And my last question, the iridium flares, they seem to be a good talking point because these things bounce off the atmosphere quite regularly. What are the iridium flares?
Well, they don't bounce off the atmosphere.
They fly past. No, what do they do?
The iridium satellites fleet was sent up about 10 years ago now to aid in phone communications, but not the sort of phone that you would have in your pocket, but rather these large phones that you would take out into the desert or Antarctica or in the middle of the Pacific.
Those big clunky satellite phones.
Yeah, the big satellite phone. That's a good way of putting it, Graham. But unfortunately, the cost was so prohibitive for people to actually use it that the company went broke.
They did, and they couldn't sell
them,
could they?
They spent about $5 billion sending up this fleet of about 70-odd satellites.
Wow.
And then they sold them all for about $7 million to a small company that kept them afloat. The satellites themselves have three very shiny panels on them, highly reflective.
Mm-hmm.
And it's these panels, about the size of a large front door, that catch the angle of the sun at certain times and reflect it back down onto the Earth. And if you're on the footprint of that reflection, you get to see this satellite which starts very, very faintly, then getting brighter and brighter and brighter, sometimes much brighter than the planet Venus, in fact, and then fading down again to to something that you wouldn't even notice. And that's the iridium flare that we see. Okay.
And they're so bright that you can even see them in daylight hours.
Can you really? If you know where to look, you can see them. I haven't seen one yet, but if you really know where to look.
Certainly early in the evenings, you can see them even in metro areas.
Anywhere.
But you have to be in the right spot. Because it might not, in the west of Melbourne, might not see the same view as the east of Melbourne.
No. And Graham, what you need to do then is to get onto a website called heavens-above.com.
Oh, yes.
And at that particular site, you put in your suburb or your town, or if you like, just Melbourne.
Yep.
Even though you can find one for Burwood, you can just put in Burwood, do a search on their database, and Burwood will come up.
Yep.
And then you go back and you look under ISS, which is the International Space Station, or Iridium Flares, and they'll tell you
what time and when
and where.
Yeah, yep. Good.
In azimuth, which is around the horizon, in starting from north, so 90 degrees would be east, 180 south and whatever, mm-hmm. and altitude, which is also displayed in degrees from north to 90, 90 being the point directly above your head, and north being the point at the horizon. Okay.
And again, we'll put all these websites, all these links up on the website.
This will be very busy tonight, won't I?
No matter where you are in the world, you can see Iridium satellites.
Fantastic.
Good. Perry, look, thank you so much for coming in and having a chat to us this evening. It's been absolutely fantastic. I, for one, will be coming along to one of these meetings because one of those things I've always been interested in but never know quite where to start. But now I know. So, Perry, thank you very much. We can contact your organisation through the website, asv.org.au.
Certainly can. And if people want to send me an email directly, it's Perry, P-E-R-R-Y, at asv.org.au.
Fantastic.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to the summer series of Tech Talk Radio. Right now, here's another memorable View from the Couch by Tech Talk Radio's Adam Turner.
Let me tell you a story of telco incompetence on a mind-numbing scale. I've just spent 4 hours arguing with Optus and Telstra in order to get my home phone switched back on. This is what happened. I'm moving my home phone from the Optus cable to the Telstra copper line in preparation for moving house in a few weeks' time. Now, Telstra are coming out next Tuesday to get it done. Yesterday, my line got cut off for no apparent reason. This was about 5 o'clock. I was actually on the phone with Optus at the time, ironically. So I ring Optus to say, why have you cut off my phone? And they think about it for half an hour and bounce me around from person to person and say, actually, it's not our fault. What's happened is Telstra's taken your number too soon. They've started the porting process when they shouldn't have. There's nothing we can do to fix it because Telstra now has the number. You need to get them to finish the porting process. Okay, so I ring Telstra. Another 30 minutes on hold. No, sorry, nothing to do with us. All Optus's fault. We haven't touched your number. So I ring Optus. Telstra's got the thing. I can see it here in the system. I think I'm speaking to a supervisor at this time. I can see it here in the system. The process is second from last done. They've done this. They haven't done that. Even gave me the technical details. Ring back Telstra again. No, Optus are lying to you. It's not true. There's probably a fault with the line that they can't be bothered fixing because they know you're leaving next week. I swear to God, it's not our fault. And he told me the status of the job in their system as well. So he's saying, look, it's got nothing to do with us. We can't do it. Optus has your number. So I ring back Optus again and say, can you check my line for a fault? And they say, yeah, we've checked it. There is no fault. By the way, it's Telstra's fault because they've taken your number. You need to speak to the porting department. They're not open now. You need to ring back tomorrow. So that was 2 hours on the phone. So then this morning, I ring them back again. No, you can't speak to the porting department. They don't speak to people. And I got cut off once or twice while I'm talking to them. So I ring back again and again. I finally get through to a lady in faults. She sounds like she's from Bangalore. She's a bit difficult to understand, but she's extremely helpful. Within about 5 minutes, she says, yeah, okay, I can see in the system your line has been accidentally disconnected. She doesn't try to blame Telstra. She doesn't try to pass the buck. She does some magic thing that no one else at Optus could figure out how to do and just says, yeah, we've disconnected you at the switch. I'll send an email to someone. We'll get it reconnected again. I'm thinking, great. So I said to her, look, what did you do? Explain it to me so I can complain to Optus and tell them everyone else is freaking useless and you fixed it. So she told me what she did. She sold me a name. 15 minutes later, while I'm on the phone to the TIO, because I figured if she can't fix it, that's the only way it's going to get done, she rings me on the home phone and says, yeah, I fixed it. I'm like, you're fantastic. Thank you very much. So I ring Optus back to make the mother of all complaints because I've now wasted, three and a half hours on the phone. I'm just getting close to the end of finishing my complaint call and I get cut off again. And I pick up the phone and it's dead. The morons have cut off my phone again. So I've got to ring them back again from another line and saying, you are completely stupid. What have you done? Don't try and blame Telstra. I know it's your fault. Don't tell me you can't fix it because you fixed it in 10 minutes before. Bloody fix it again. So they say, oh, yeah, sorry, actually what happened is we reconnected your service, but we didn't change the disconnection date in the system, which was set for yesterday accidentally. So after a few minutes, the system went, your phone's supposed to be disconnected, and cut me off again. So I got them to fix it again, and then I had to ring back the complaints guy again and say, you know that complaint? And he said, yeah, you got cut off. And I know, you wouldn't believe this, you bloody cut my phone off again. He's like, no way. And I'm like, yes way, you cut my phone off twice. So he was very understanding. And so he put another thing on the system. They got rid of the disconnection date for my phone completely and said, look, we'll wait for Telstra. They also kept getting the disconnection date wrong for my Optus cable, and I was worried they were going to cut off my internet access and then I really have to kill someone because that's far more important than my own phone. So it looks like we've finally got it sorted out, and then the guy from Telstra says he will credit me $50 on my final bill for the time wasted. Now, I've wasted 4 or 5 hours. I work for myself. I don't know about you, but my time is worth more than $50 for 4 hours. But finally, it looks like I actually have dial tone on my home phone again, and let's see if Optus can actually resist the urge to cut it off until Telstra takes over as my provider, and then they can have the joy of screwing up my phone service. Isn't it great to live in a country like Australia?
Entertaining. Wait. Informative.
Wait. There's more. As I was recording this, I thought that my phone had been fixed because I had dial tone and I could ring out. Then my mobile phone rang from Optus saying they were trying to fix my line. I'm like, what, you just fixed it after you cut it off? She said, yeah, I know we cut off. I said, you cut it off twice. She's like, twice? I'm like, yes, you cut it off twice. And she's like, well, I just tried to ring you and I still can't get through. So I checked and yes, I can make calls out, but I can't receive incoming calls. So it looks like there is actually a vault on the line, as well as general Optus incompetence continually disconnecting the service. So the reason why I couldn't find the fault is because they kept cutting the damn phone off anyway. So I still can't receive home calls. I'm getting a little frustrated here. Okay, it's a few hours later now and I'm a little bit calmer. But Optus' incompetence seems to know no bounds. Optus fixed my phone this morning, then cut it off, then fixed it again, but I could make outgoing calls, but I couldn't receive incoming calls. So I rang them back, and then we started it all again because they kept trying to tell me it was Telstra's fault because Telstra was trying to take the number. I ended up screaming at someone on the phone who refused to concede that it must be Optus's fault because Optus had managed to briefly fix the phone only a few hours earlier. I then spoke to someone else who also still said that Telstra was to blame, but that she'd bring me back by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was now about midday and I hadn't actually done any work, so I thought it might be time to do a few other things. About 2:30, I'd calmed down enough to try again. So I rang back Optus, I asked for faults, and I got through to Yazan, who also sounded like he was from the subcontinent. Now, as with the previous Indian support person, Yazan listened very carefully to my story and immediately conceded that Optus was at fault. He said he'd look into it and call me back. And 5 minutes later, he rang me back on the home phone. Presto, fixed, just like that. He said the problem was in the exchange but had something to do with my number being in limbo. Regardless, he said that he thought it was fixed for good now. On a hunch, I asked him to check on the cancellation of my internet access, which was supposed to be August 8, but for some reason kept changing the system to August 15. He came back and said it had been changed to August 5. Lucky I checked. or I would have been in for another screaming match with Optus when they cut off my internet too soon. So it looks like after more than 5 hours on the phone, I finally fixed the problem. The most interesting thing is that it was the Indians who were the most helpful. They were the ones who listened, and they were the ones who could instantly fix the problem, where the Aussies were just more concerned about telling me it was Telstra's fault and there was nothing they could do. Hopefully, this is the end of it, but with telephone companies, you just never know.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work, visiting the relatives, washing the car.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And that you are. We're back. Welcome back, everybody. And one of our guests in this evening is Brian Ackley. Now, Brian has... What do you do for a living, Brian?
I work as an electronics engineer for a company who does data radio products.
Okay. Nothing to do with batteries, obviously. But have a very good interest in batteries just because of the equipment that you guys made. You want to try and get the length of operability, I guess.
That's exactly right.
Out of your batteries. Now, we've all done the big sort of like, which battery should I buy for which device? And, of course, this day and age, everybody uses batteries, from the smoke alarm through the digital camera and things like that. So, and we've got rechargeable options. We've got different technologies, you name it. They're all out there. And I guess that's one of the reasons why we thought you'd come in for a visit and tell us what the differences is between these batteries and rechargeables and things like that, and why some are better than others. So let's start off with things like, I guess, the supermarket batteries and what we do in our day-to-day life, like the digital camera and things like that. So you've done lots of tests with batteries. Are any batteries best suited for those heavy-duty load devices as opposed to your average torch or something?
Well, it turns out that I'll probably touch on this a bit more later, but some of the rechargeables that are out there now are doing some pretty good work as far as for high drain applications and so forth. They have some downsides, but the alkalines too. I mean, there's lots of different versions, lots of different brands, and all that sort of thing, and it is rather confusing. There's also some very expensive ones. I mean, you mentioned digital cameras, for example, are an example of a fairly power-hungry item. And the lithium, single-use lithium batteries, they're rather expensive, but they do function very well in high-drain devices. They can be fairly heavily discharged, and they still retain their capacity, which a lot of other alkalines in particular, have a bit of trouble with after... some types anyway seem to be better than others, but generally they tend to plummet. Their voltage dies fairly quickly under very heavy load.
So okay. What would be a heavy drain device besides the camera? You said the digital camera, which has got the flash and the screen it's got to run. What else would be a heavy duty device, and what would be light duty?
No, I guess...
Torches, just the little pen light ones, the kids' ones, they'd all be light duty sort of things. But
relatively.
If you're talking your mag lights or something like that, you're talking of.
And you look at your remote control, that'd be lightweight for your TV or VCR, because that only really works when you push the button, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
The battery in the clock in our living room the other day that had died after running for years.
And your battery backup, in your clock radio and things like that.
Yeah.
And your smoke alarm battery would be fairly lightweight usage.
Fairly low. These are all applications that are quite good for alkaline batteries because you can put them in there. They have a very high capacity if they're put under light load, and they have a fairly long usable life They work well, providing you're using them at room temperatures and a bit above. What they don't work well at is a lot of people don't realise this. You can't use them in very low temperature conditions. They lose something like 40% of their capacity at 0 degrees.
Sorry, Tasmania.
So what is a good battery for, say, taking it up the snow, if you're going to use a radio up the snow? Oh, or
definitely
else?
Lithium.
So lithiums are good, are they?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
If you're going for cold temperatures, always go for lithium, even though you have to pay the extra for it.
That's right.
So if you walk into the supermarket, as most people would probably buy their batteries there, you're normally confronted with this wall of things hanging in front of you, which some are silver, some are red, some are black, some are strange colours that you've never seen before. On average, what type of, like, your traditional, and let's use brand names here, like your Everready's and your Duracell's, what type of technology are those batteries?
They're all alkaline. Those ones that you mentioned, the Duracells, the...
So would there be more alkaline hanging on the shelf than there would be any other technology?
There tends to be, yeah. The ones that are sort of falling out of favour more these days are things like the Everready Reds and Blacks, you know, the so-called heavy-duty batteries. They really don't cut the mustard these days. They're okay in devices which are fairly light duty, but when you look at it, they don't really give you that much in value for money if you've got something that you're, like, say, for example, your smoke alarms and so forth. Mm. If you use them in that, they have a fairly high self-discharge and they don't tend to last very long, mm-hmm. whereas an alkaline battery will give many, many years of useful service in that application.
So with something like that, we're talking about, even though it's got a light duty, like the smoke alarm, the shelf life of an Everready Red or a Black, which are like your carbon something...
Zinc carbon
batteries, isn't as good as an alkaline, so you're still better to go for the alkaline.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so in my view, from what I've seen with doing discharge tests on them, that certainly seems to be the case.
Speaking of storage, do any batteries or any technologies last longer sitting in the packet in the shelf in the kitchen?
Definitely. The lithium probably are about the best when it comes to that. The lithium, I mean, there's a reason for why they cost what as much as they do.
And they are an expensive battery.
They're about $10 for a pair, roughly, of the supermarket prices. So
that's about four times the cost of your standard alkaline or something?
It'd be probably four or five.
Okay. So quite expensive.
Yeah, but you know that's the thing. You can expect if you've got a device which is used every now and then, like say for example you've got a piece of equipment that you want to take off the shelf and use maybe once or twice a year, but you want it to work when you want to use it. You might lithium is a good choice there because really when you look at it, the service life of that piece of equipment is quite long. You need to depend on it, and you need to make sure that. That like you don't want to have to replace it periodically just in case the battery might die. So in that sort of application, it can give you very good value for money. An alkaline, for example, would probably have... They tend to have a bit more self-discharge. And I know on the side of them, they say some of them have like, you know, usable until 2011 or something like that.
Okay.
But you won't get your full capacity out of them at that date.
So what you're saying is really that the price of the battery really is indicative of its shelf life in a lot of respects?
In a way, yes. The technology is more indicative of it. The price of the like with the alkalines, for example, the sort of service life you'll get out of them tends to be fairly similar as far as their usable life. But one of the things this was always a curiosity for me. This is where it all started off, was because I was always wondering whether your Rockets and your Maxells and your Acmes and stuff like that, how they stacked up against the likes of the Duracells and the Everettys and so forth. And it turns out, like, I did some tests with an application that was fairly heavy drain. It was a radio product which was used relatively frequently. And you'd get, like, something in the order of about 2 to 3 hours of use out of it. I was in particular interested to see what types of batteries worked out to be, whether any of them worked out more cost-effective in these applications.
All right. So tell us a bit about your experiment, because I think Mark alluded earlier on, whether it was one of the previous shows, that you'd spent over a year or so testing out all these batteries in many various conditions from fridges and freezers to...
Yeah. I'll probably get to that just in a sec, because one of the things I meant to mention about this was that what I found with doing these tests was that you basically get what you pay for with them. You can buy cheaper versions of alkaline batteries, for example, but you don't get the same life out of them. As it turns out, when you actually work it out in a dollar per hour type rating for a particular device, you actually get much the same. If you buy a cheaper battery, you will get a bit less use out of it in general.
But you'll be changing your batteries more frequently.
You'll be changing your batteries more often. That's right.
That's a good way to actually measure it, Brian, isn't it? Like dollar per hour. So you're sort of comparing apples with apples, aren't you? You can say, look, I can buy this type of battery, but I'm going to need to buy four of these to last the same length of time as this brand is going to last. Yeah,
it's
just one battery.
Not quite that much. It's like you might be looking at, say, say an Acme or something like that might last, say, 75% of the, well, maybe 80% of the time of a standard Energizer, for example.
So when you're comparing like with like, so when you're comparing alkalines, between the Acme brand and the Energizer, it might be 80% for the Acme one. That's when you're comparing like for like.
That's
It does vary when you're comparing non-like for like.
Yes, that's right. But as it turns out, they're pretty well all work out to be about the same dollar per hour rating in all the alkalines. That was the interesting thing that I found. The other interesting thing was that what doesn't make sense is if you try and use some of these really cheap and nasty $2 shop batteries.
Okay.
They die very, very quickly.
So what was the worst battery you tested? Let's start off at the bottom and work our way up.
Okay. My favourite classic worst battery.
Is it a Kmart brand?
No, it wasn't a Kmart brand.
It was a $2 shop battery
and it was called a Rotasonic.
Rotasonic.
Yes, it looked like a Duracell. Exactly. It had all of the same label. It even had the battery tester on the side of it.
Same colour scheme,
except the battery tester didn't have anything in it. It was just the picture of a battery tester.
Yeah. I've seen them before.
Yeah.
Oh, that came out of China, I reckon.
Yeah.
So you didn't go back and buy a second one, just thought, no, this can't be right.
No, I went back actually a couple of months later, and I noticed that they'd changed their brand name. It looked exactly the same, but they were called a Keneng battery after that.
And
funny enough, I bought a set of them because, like, you know, $2, well, it's not much to have to worry about. And I was
all
curious.
In the name of science,
all
isn't
in the name
it?
Of science, yes. And I put them in, and yes, I got the whole, I think, 1 minute of discharge out of it
Now, this is on the standard test that you did on all the batteries.
That's on the standard test I did with all batteries. Yeah. Where in this particular stuff, on a fairly heavy load drain, most batteries worked out to be about $1 per hour.
Yeah.
These ones effectively worked out to be $20 per hour.
Wow.
So they don't really make a lot of...
And they were the cheapest to buy as a pack of two or four.
They were the cheapest to buy. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, that company's got a good margin if they can get the volume of sales up, I guess.
Well, that's how they make their money. I mean, people would buy them thinking that they were really cheap and they do the job, but in actual fact, it's going to cost people like $20 per hour to actually use this brand.
That's right.
That's how they're making money.
Yeah.
What was the best one, Brian, at the other end?
Let's move up the scale a bit. How did the average... Like, as a shopper, you probably, everyone in the course of time would have bought the Everready's.
Yeah.
Just because they're a brand name and everyone's sort of used to that. How did they fare?
They were not too bad. The Energizer on my list ended up being about number three.
Well, that's pretty good.
They're best. What about the Everready red and black that we see? Heavy duties and the super heavy duties.
Well, that was quite interesting, actually.
Because a lot of people that buy those because of the brand and that they've been there for so long. You think they've been there for a while, they've got to be good. Are they?
Well, not really. They're not an alkaline battery anyway. They're good for low drain applications.
And they're cheaper in the shops.
They are cheaper in the
hanging
shops.
Hanging up against the other ones.
The interesting thing was that the heavy duty and the super heavy duty, you'd get the idea that the super heavy duty would be a lot bigger capacity, much, much better. Well, as it turned out, when I did the tests, the super heavy duty, the more expensive one, died before the heavy duty one did.
So, you got the wrong packet.
That one had a long shelf life.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope so. Otherwise, we're all getting ripped, aren't we?
Yeah. I wonder how they justify their marketing in that case. I wonder if, like, that's obviously not an isolated example, Brian, because you've done a long scientific test here.
It's all single uses. I mean, you've got to take into account that these are one-off purchases, more for interest's sake than a thorough sort of exam, like buying, you know, 10 different ones of different use-by dates and all that from all over the place and doing a properly... averaged result.
So it might have been a slightly skewy test result.
It could have been. But it was the interesting thing was that, you know, although one sort of seemed to be a bit better than the other, they both seemed to have roughly the same result. I mean, they were in the middle of the pack. There was a big difference between them, the $2 shop batteries, and the alkalines.
All right. And the next battery, I guess, would be interesting to know is the pink rabbit thing that, you know, keeps on keeping on and runs around. They really, there's those guys, and then there's the Energizer, the little thing that keeps on keeping on too. That, see those, that funny thing.
Yeah,
so
you see those ads on television for the Duracells, and they compare themselves to the Eveready Black because they won't compare themselves to an alkaline battery, which is the Energizer.
So they have to be factually correct when they do television.
And they put all their disclaimers down the bottom now. Yeah. I keep reading them over and over again.
So how did those sort of, because we instinctively think that, you know, the Duracell or the Copper Top is a better battery compared to some of the others. How did that one shape up in the test?
The Duracell, I'm going to have to look at my list now, actually ended up being about middle of the lot. They were quite good. The one that really shone out, which was interesting, was the Duracell Ultra. They've got a new version of it. I'm not sure what the difference is in chemistries or so forth. But they seem to be head and shoulders above the rest as far as actual capacity and length of time. The one that was a bit of a disappointment was the Eveready version, which was the titanium one, which, like, these batteries are a lot more expensive than the standard alkalines. And you sort of get the idea that, oh, yeah, you know, you're getting this, you know, extra capacity. You might be getting twice the life out of it or something. Like, well, it's not anything like that. You might get an extra 10 or 15, 20% or so. But you're paying, you know, that extra margin in price. And once again, when you actually work it out, when you do the tests, it ends up being much the same dollar per hour rating, you know, very, very similar. The one that I thought was really interesting, and there has been some talk about this recently, apparently, is things like the Rocket Alkaline is... it's very good value for money. That was probably of the top ranking as far as if you're for price comparison and so forth for the sorts of batteries that you could buy as a pair.
Yep.
And the one that really shone out was these things that you get from Dick Smith, the bulk pack Digitor things.
Really?
Yeah, they were quite amazing.
Are they the top of your list? Is that one of the best value for money?
They have been. It's not really a fair comparison because in a dollar per hour rating, they work out where others will work out around a dollar. They end up being about 39 cents. But
And that's because you bought them in a 40-pack,
I think it was.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're getting the
economy of scale there. You're buying plenty of them and they last.
But it's good to know that they're good as well, capacity-wise. Well,
the capacity was the best of the lot as far as the alkaline.
That's really important, though, because if you're, like, I know Mark has kids, I have kids, Rodden doesn't, but
not that I know of.
At the end of the, not that you're earning up to. At the end of the day, when you buy batteries, you buy either rechargeables or you buy batteries in bulk like this for the toys and things like that.
When Brian did his test, I went and bought the 40 pack, and I also have an alkaline recharger at home, so I actually recharge them again. If they're not too dead, I recharge them. I get sort of two or three uses from them.
So you can recharge
if you have the right charger.
All right, we'll come back and talk about that. I think we'll take a break and we'll be back in just a moment. We were talking to Brian Ackley about batteries, and we'll talk about rechargeables versus non-rechargeables after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Plasma TVs may be banned. Oh, my goodness.
I don't care. They will pry my plasma out of my cold, dead hand.
Microsoft issued 7 security patches in a regular update.
Yep, there's a debate as to whether by turning off the ads, you're effectively stealing the content.
What about the three of us? We can't give up our day jobs.
Yes, absolutely.
We could be the three amigos.
We could.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
Here's another great moment in technology on Tech Talk Radio.
In August 1981, Telecom Australia launched the first public automatic mobile phone system in Melbourne, with Sydney following in November of that year. Commonly referred to as the 007 network after its telephone number prefix, the system was fully automatic but not cellular. In 1987, Telecom launched Australia's first cellular mobile phone network based on the analog AMPS standard, the advanced mobile phone system used widely in the United States. In just 2 years, 100,000 services were connected to Telecom's AMPS network. 1992 saw some landmark changes to the Australian mobile telecommunications landscape. Optus and Vodafone were both licensed as Australian telecommunications carriers, while Telecom signed its 500,000th customer on the continually expanding AMPS network. In 1993, Telecom changed its trading name to Telstra and heralded the second generation of mobile technology with the introduction of a new digital GSM mobile telephone network. Vodafone and Optus also launched their own GSM networks, providing for the first time ever a choice of mobile phone operators for Australian subscribers. By 1998, Telstra's AMPS and GSM customers exceeded 3 million, and plans were announced to build a new digital network replacing AMPS. This new network would be based on CDMA, or Code Division Multiple Access, digital technology. Within 2 years of this announcement, Telstra had launched its CDMA network, as had new kid on the block Hutchison, with its own CDMA network in Sydney and Melbourne. 2003 saw frenetic activity with Hutchison launching their 3 service, the first so-called third-generation network in Australia. Today, Vodafone and Optus are sharing a 3G network, while Telstra has committed to build its own 3G network to allow it to eliminate the dual CDMA-GSM architecture and converge on one high-speed, cost-effective system. This has been another great moment in technology on Tech Talk Radio.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to the studio, Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb here with Dr. Ron Mark Diggins, and our guest this evening is Brian Ackerley. We're talking all about batteries, lithium batteries, carbon batteries, you name it, rechargeables, non-rechargeables. And one thing before we went to the break we were going to talk about was the cost per dollar on lithiums and how the lithiums fared up in the big picture, Brian.
Yeah, the lithiums were actually quite interesting. And the application that I was trying them out in, considering that their initial cost, you'd sort of get the idea that these would have to be a real good performer and so forth, have to be really worth the money. Why are they so expensive? Well, as it turns out, where you'd get, in this particular application that I was looking at, where you'd get, say, about 3 hours out of a standard alkaline, you get about 12-odd hours out of the lithium. So they actually were very... They looked like they're very good value for money as far as replacement. You didn't need to replace them anywhere near as often. But their actual cost per hour still ended up being much the same as the alkalines, really, in this particular application. Where they're really good is they keep the same voltage throughout their whole life, whereas the alkalines tend to drop.
So you didn't really gain anything in the cost per hour, but what you did gain was the convenience of not having to change them 4 times in that same amount of period.
Because one of the main things with batteries is, as you just alluded to there, Brian, was maintaining the voltage, because the voltage is sort of like the water pressure in the battery side of things to keep the right pressure onto the device that you
That's
need.
That's right, yeah.
And I guess... when it came to maintaining voltage over time, did any one particular battery stand out, or did some? Because a lot of them sort of like disappear off gradually or slowly,
yes,
and some fall away really quickly. So, anything stand out in that part of the test?
Well, the ones that fall away very quickly are the so called heavy duty batteries.
It's bizarre how they call them heavy duty batteries when that happens.
I think it's at the time when they maybe invented, they were probably the heaviest duty thing they had.
It was probably named back 20 years ago or something
exactly
like that.
That's exactly right, yeah. Alkalines fall away, probably maintain their voltage a lot better, but they do tend to fall off gradually. They only maintain their 1.5 volts for the very, very early in their life, and they fall away very quickly after that. And to the point where when they're classed as flat, they're about half their voltage when they really plummet. They're not really usable at that voltage. But the interesting thing is the lithium stays head and shoulders above them all. It's the one that maintains the highest voltage throughout its lifetime. But the other one that also, and I'm sure there's probably people out there are probably saying, what about rechargeable batteries? I mean, how do they fare? It's a sort of a well-known thing amongst technical people that the rechargeable nickel-cadmium and nickel-hydride-type batteries...
Well, NiCads were the first ones out there. In the break there about... We all had NiCads when we... And they had that thing called the memory effect of all things.
Yeah, well, there's a bit of controversy about that as to whether it's actually real or not.
It was like the only consumable rechargeable battery for a long time, wasn't it? Obviously, you had like car battery technology and gel cells and things like
that's
that.
Right,
but if you wanted to put a battery into an electronic device, you had NiCad, and that was it, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. The NiCad, you're going to see them pretty much disappear, and a lot of people probably think, oh, that's because nickel hydride is so much better. I mean, you know, they've gone in some pretty big strides as far as their capacities is concerned with the nickel hydrides. When they first came out, they were a very poor cousin to the NiCad, effectively, because the capacities, although they appeared to have similar capacities, or in some cases just under that of the NiCad, they had a very high internal resistance, and they tended to
to not really be that good in high drain applications.
What's an internal resistance for the mums and dads out there?
An internal resistance. Now, how do you put it in layman's terms? It's the thing that that kills the battery voltage when you put it under load. Like, for example, if you were to take, and this is where nickel hydrides and nickel cadmium batteries are really good, is in things like electric drills and so forth, because they have a very low internal resistance. It means that when you put a heavy load on them, they don't dissipate any, they don't waste power in heat.
Okay.
To heat up the, effectively heat up the battery. That's what.
Because every compound has a resistance for electricity to flow through it.
Yes.
And that resistance is dissipated in heat.
That's right.
So the less in the battery, the less you're wasting as heat in the battery.
That's
when
exactly you're right.
So you want to, rather than burn heat up in the battery, you want to get it into the appliance.
That's right.
You want the electrical energy, don't you? Not heat energy.
Yeah. The more heat you dissipate in the battery, the less goes into the appliance. Mm. And effectively too, when you have that happen, what that seems to do is there seems to be an effect where batteries that have high internal resistance, this is one of the things with the alkaline, for example, as it gets older, as it gets more depleted, the internal resistance goes up. And that then effectively means that you're generating more heat in the battery. So it in some applications, in some devices, the power supply or the that recognizes that the voltage is actually going lower, and in order to maintain its operation, will actually suck more power out of the battery in order to maintain its usability. And that sort of creates a double whammy effect where the thing will die very quickly. Uh-huh. In an alkaline's case, you end up with a significant reduction in service life. And this is where nickel hydrides, for example, have been are very good. Some of the capacities of them, I've done some tests recently to show that their actual voltage, even though they're published as being 1.2-volt batteries rather than 1.5, for some of the applications that you'll use them in, providing they can handle a slightly lower voltage, they actually maintain a very constant voltage over their entire charge lifetime. And the 2.5 amp hour or 2500 milliamp hour nickel hydride batteries, AA nickel metal hydrides.
I'll just jump in there. 250 milliamp hour batteries or 2,500. That means the battery can provide that amount of current.
Yeah.
For an hour.
If 2.5 amps you can drain out of it for an hour, or as it goes, for 10 hours, 250 milliamps,
yep.
For example. It actually works out that the more load you put on it, you don't actually get the 2.5 amp hours. You will get somewhat less, but it's still a lot more than what you would get out of an alkaline, for example. And this is mm-hmm. one of the tests that I did. The other interesting thing of them is that they tend to be a little bit heavier than alkalines. Like
physically heavier?
Physically heavier, yeah. The published capacity of the nickel hydride, 2.5 amp hours, it weighs nearly 30 grams, whereas an alkaline, the published capacity of 2.7 amp hours, somewhat more, as it shows, is about 24 grams. So just a few grams less. The lithium is by far the lightest of the lot. They're really, mm-hmm. really
and that's
good.
Because of the compound that they're made from, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. Like the lithium's half the weight of the nickel hydride. Mm-hmm. It's about 14 grams.
Well, you're talking more capacity too.
Yeah, yeah.
We were mentioning before about NiCad's being on the way out because what, cadmium is now a banned substance or something?
Yes, that's right. Cadmium is
something with marijuana.
Yeah. Cadmium has been
smoked.
I wouldn't go either.
Or cadmium. Mm. It can't be good for you.
In the European Union legislated in the start of this month, actually, that cadmium was no longer allowed to be used in consumer products, essentially. Mm-hmm. Well, in just about all products, unless you've got a particular reason for why you have to have an exemption.
I have to find out why. Like, is it carcinogenic or something? Or?
It's to do with a thing called ROHS, which is Restriction of Hazardous Substances, which is to do with recycling of electronic goods, like
so
things like...
Okay,
so
it doesn't recycle well.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
Yeah. And polluting
right.
atmosphere. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Brian, while we're talking about the new nickel metal hydride technology, with the old NiCad batteries, we used to have a phenomenon called like a memory effect. And everyone who used those sorts of batteries knew that you often had to discharge them completely before you recharge them. Otherwise, you've shortened the life of them.
That's what they say to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, is that still the case with nickel metal hydride?
Or? It's reportedly not the case with nickel hydrides. I've yet to actually do some tests on this. This is something that I will...
But they must eventually wear out, surely.
They do. You supposedly, NICADs used to say you can get up to 1,000 uses. Well, depends on how you use them, how heavily you drain them.
I'd like to find the person who actually got 1,000 uses.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things I'd like to do a test of eventually one day, but it's going to take some time to get around to. The nickel hydrides supposedly don't have this memory effect. You can partially discharge and partially recharge them, and it's supposed to. They're not supposed to suffer the same problems.
Okay. Are there any batteries in the rechargeable side of things which stand out apart from others, or are they all pretty much made of the same material, aren't they? They're all. You really look when you're buying a rechargeable, you're looking at your milliamp hours as a rating and how long they last as he holds up a graph to me, and we'll talk about these graphs shortly too.
Sorry, it was a bit how long they last as far as recharging them.
Well, if you're looking for a rechargeable battery, one of your buying criteria should be obviously the larger number on the side. If it's a 2,000 milliamp hour battery or 2.5 hours, that's really your only buying criteria, isn't it?
Yeah, basically. Well, I mean, it comes down to price. You know, I mean, the higher capacity ones, of course, they charge more for them. One of the things that you've got to be aware of, though, with the nickel hydride batteries in all of these, like nickel hydride and nickel cadmium, is that they don't have a very good shelf life. They will die very quickly. You can't expect to use them in something that you want to use for a year and then recharge the battery. They're only really good for day-to-day use devices because after about a month they lose, I've forgotten what the percentage is, but something in the order of about 40% of their capacity. Whereas wow. Alkalines, lithiums and so forth, you can leave them on the shelf for years and they'll still be quite usable.
Uh-huh. So just tell us about your interesting experiment with your storage life, just quickly.
Yeah, well, when it comes to, I mean, that's one of the things, like with these, I only really did this test on alkalines because I was curious about what would happen. One of the things that happened was my mother used to always store her batteries in the fridge, and I used to think that was quite strange. Why
with the film, hey?
I was about to say, along with the
old Kodak 200.
Well, she was into photography too, so she used to do this. She had this
it was all together, that's why.
It was all together, yeah. On the one shelf on the fridge was the batteries and the film and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, I thought...
Heaven help someone raiding the fridge at night.
Yes. So I thought, well, I'll do some tests anyway. And what I did is I took a set of batteries, they were the standard Eveready Energizers. And I put one set in the just stored them at room temperature. I stored another set in the fridge, another set in the freezer for 12 months, and I got another set that I put in the temperature chamber at work, where we cycled them daily from -20 to +70 degrees twice a day.
Oh, that'd get you going, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and the idea was to simulate what would happen if you left the batteries in the car, taken to the extreme, I guess.
Went
from exactly.
The snow to the desert,
from the snow.
Pop them in the Mars lander. Do they use energy Eveready?
My expectation would be that they would be completely unusable. They would all...
That's what you would expect. Yeah. The interesting thing was when I finally got the batteries out after 12 months, the plastic on the outside, the label had split down the side of both batteries, and I thought they hadn't leaked, but I thought, oh, these are going to be just completely dead by the time I put them in there. Well, the interesting thing was that they only showed a very slight decrease in discharge as far as, like, they certainly died quicker under discharge than the ones that had been stored at room temperature or in the fridge or freezer. But the interesting thing was that the ones that had been frozen or refrigerated performed much the same as far as their discharge curve was concerned as the one that had been stored at room temperature. So
how about that?
It was quite amazing, which basically means that there's no real... If you're only going to store them for a year or so, there is no real
advantage.
Don't put
them in the fridge.
There's no point. You might get a slight advantage, but you're never going to see it.
So you've busted an urban myth for us.
Busted an urban
fantastic
myth.
That's what it's all about. Now, we have to wrap up, boys. A quick question, Brian, before we go. If you were walking into the shop and you wanted to buy some batteries for the torch or something like that, what would you buy? Lithium?
No, not for the torch. I'd just buy alkaline.
Okay. So your generic alkalines for the torch?
Yeah.
What about for the digital camera?
It depends, I guess, whether it's an older, very power-hungry one, in which case you probably have to buy lithiums because you probably just won't get a usable... You won't be able to get through the life of the, you know, day's use of the camera otherwise. But a lot of the newer ones, I mean, power drain is starting to drop off a bit with those, and you're starting to get a lot more efficient.
And I find with my camera, I have nickel metal hydrides in my camera, and I find that by the time I go to use
they're
it 3 weeks...
Ones.
Yep, the rechargeable ones. Yeah. By the time I go to use it 3 weeks later, like Brian was saying, they could be 40% flat, so I only get a few shots out of it before the battery indicator comes up, and then I'm dead. So,
but as far as value is concerned, I would say the nickel hydrides, if the camera can take them, can handle a lower voltage, then definitely they would be the way to go. They would work out to be the most cost efficient.
Thank you very much, Brian, for coming in and sharing that information with us. If you've got any questions, anything like that, feel free to send us an email at feedback@techtalkradio.com.au about batteries, and we'll forward them on to Brian.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Microsoft plugging a few more holes. That's what they do these days.
Listen up, LG, Pioneer, everybody else. All the majors. Yeah, get with it. We want web servers and Ethernet ports.
It's good to see some genuine enforcement going on. I think it should happen a lot more often.
That's how I read it. Is that how you read it?
No, 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 no. What he's done, he's done the right thing. He's gone out there and said, hey, this is really crap.
There's been a lot of face pulling and gurning in the studio here this evening.
They do
it's
nothing
the
to...
subject beautifully.
No, well, this is what I'm paid the big bucks
exactly.
for.
Exactly.
Sorry to say it.
No, don't be sorry to say it. I serve purely as a warning to people.
This is amazing stuff. This is stuff that computers are traditionally really, really bad at, that humans do so easily.
When it's off, it's off. You know what I mean?
Yep.
When there's...
It's a physical off, isn't it? As opposed to a soft off.
Polly vu francais?
Polly wants a what?
Yes, exactly.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to the summer series of Tech Talk Radio. Right now, here's another memorable view from the couch by Tech Talk Radio's Adam Turner.
Time Warner cable users in the US may lose their God-given right to unlimited downloads. Texans have been threatened with download caps and excess usage fees. My heart bleeds for them. It really does. Time Warner Cable has started a riot in the blogosphere by threatening to restrict users to a paltry 40 gigabytes per month and charging them a whopping $1 per gigabyte for excess data usage. This is on a 15 megabits per second service costing $55 a month. As a long-time Australian broadband user, I feel their pain. I mean, come on, Time Warner. 40 gig per month, that's only 1.3 gig per day. How can anyone survive on such rations? Sure, it means practically unlimited email, instant messaging, web browsing, VoIP, and streaming music and downloads, but that only leaves 1 gig a day for other forms of entertainment. How can any civilized person make do with only 10 full-length movies per week or 20 television shows? What if someone wants to download a disk image, a Linux distro, or a bunch of system updates? That's one less movie they can watch that week. Time Warner, can you live with yourself if a customer is forced to pay an extra dollar to download a movie? Do you really want that person's pain and suffering on your conscience? So far, Time Warner Cable is only trialing the new limits on customers in Beaumont, Texas, so it's not too late to fight back. Maybe we can call out the National Guard, or George W. can liberate Beaumont and bring about regime change to protect his fellow Texans' constitutional right to watch Juice 24/7 whilst downloading terabytes of porn. Perhaps it would be easier to find another country with vast bandwidth reserves and invade it, in the name of democracy, of course. Why should the 5% of Time Warner Cable subscribers who use up to 50% of the company's available bandwidth be punished in this way? Why should these people be forced to cough up some loose change if they exceed their monthly limit by a mere gigabyte? Why should they be expected to show a little restraint so there's enough bandwidth for everyone? What is this, communist Russia? Sure, there are some whingers who don't understand the pain and suffering Beaumont's internet community is going through, like those people sucked into signing up for 2-year, 200 megabyte per month plans with $130 per gigabyte excess data charges, or those dodos with free ADSL 2 Plus, which is shaped to 64 kilobits per second after 150 megabytes. Or anyone who lives in a country where the dominant telco can hold the country to ransom because it owns the copper and is threatening to do the same again with fibre to the node. Sure, those people won't understand Beaumont's pain, but that's the price that they pay for living in the third world. In a civilized land like Texas, who can survive on 40 gig per month? I say it's time for a class action. If I was forced to pay an extra dollar to download the latest blockbuster movie the week before it's released in the cinema, I'd be on the phone to my lawyer faster than you can say punitive damages. what Time Warner Cable is doing is un-American. If Texans can't have unlimited downloads, the terrorists win.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
So that's it for this year's summer series of Tech Talk Radio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to some of our past guests. Join us same time next week when we're all back live in the studio to discuss what's been happening over the break, as well as news and developments in the world of technology that affect us all. Don't forget to stay in touch by signing up to our mail list and following us on Twitter. Visit techtalkradio.com.au for all the details. I'm Andrew McComb. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to your company next week. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panelists Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.